And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are going to be talking today on the morning show about the fascinating nation of Cuba. And we'll be talking with two members of the faculty of Carthage College and two students who were part of a 15-day study tour to the nation of Cuba over the last few weeks during what's called J-Term at Carthage. First of all, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the morning show Jeffrey Roberg, professor of political science, who has headed up a number of such trips to Cuba, along with trips to other places over the years. And also with us is his partner in crime in this particular trip to Cuba, Maribel Morales Martinez, who is associate professor of modern languages at Carthage, and also associate provost for assessment and accreditation. And we have two of the 10 students who were along for this study tour, Lauren Bukur, who is a junior political science and Chinese major, and Claire Gunther, also a political science and Chinese major, but she is a senior. And Lauren was actually on the morning show with Professor Roberg and maybe one other student back in November, shortly after the most recent presidential election. So shifting gears now to talk about this really fascinating trip that that they and a number of other students and four community members took to the nation of Cuba. We welcome all of you to the morning show. Glad to have you here.
Thank you very much for having us.
So, Professor Roberg, you've been doing this quite some time, and before we went on the air, you were kind of giving a capsule sketch of just how long these trips to the nation of Cuba have been taking place. Explain that to our listeners, kind of the legacy or the history of this experience over the years.
Sure. So Carthage started going there in 2002. Your listeners will remember Dr. Yuri Maltsev. So he and I took students and community members back in 2002. And then we were joined by Dr. Penny Seymour in 2004 as well. And then we kind of had a break for a number of years due to some domestic politics of the United States. And then Professor Seymour and I returned in 2014 with students and community members, as well as 2016. So it's been a few years since we've been back to Cuba, but it was wonderful to get back and to see some folks that we knew from a long time ago.
Sure. I don't think we need to dwell on this point, but I think it would be interesting and helpful for our listeners to understand about these extended breaks, which, as you say, occurred especially during the last part of the Bush administration, the younger Bush, and during President Trump's first administration. What kind of changes in on sort of the political landscape here are we talking about that made traveling to Cuba during those periods either inadvisable or maybe trickier, or for whatever reason ended up sort of preventing these trips from happening?
As your listeners will know, Cuba and the United States have had an interesting relationship, we'll phrase it that way.
Do say the least.
Since for quite a long time, but obviously most recently since 1959 or so. And so the United States had placed onto Cuba a number of restrictions, and we call it part of that an embargo, followed by a variety of laws that were passed in various years that made communication, let alone travel with Cuba, a little difficult. There were some carve-outs that were made for people-to-people transfers and being able to go there. One of those is an education carve-out that exists. So in 2002 and 2004, we had a whole lot of paperwork that we had to do for the Office of Foreign Assets Control is what it's called in the United States. They're part of the Treasury Department and decide what can happen. And then with the younger Bush, George W. Bush administration, they decide to basically make it much harder for educational travel and other travel to go. There were still some travel was allowed, but it was just harder for us, and so we just kind of said, okay, we'll pass for a while. By 2014, of course, we had a different president in office. That was President Obama. He had kind of made it his plan to loosen some of the restrictions on Cuba, and it made it easier for us. And so by 2014, we didn't have to have anywhere near the type of paperwork that we did back in 2002. For 14 and 16, and I was there with Dr. Seymour for research in 2015, just the two of us, it was much easier to travel there. And then, of course, as your listeners know, we had another presidential change, and President Trump came in 2017, really kind of tightened things up again with travel to Cuba. There was still some that was available, as a personal choice, decided not to try and have to run that race, and just kind of waited things out. And then for a variety of reasons, we offered Cuba this last year, the paperwork was still simple in the scheme of things, although if you ask the students, we kept bombarding them with a variety of things, so they had a number of things they had to have on their person with them to go and not have a problem.
Right, and to be able to come back home again. Right. Well, very good. Well, we're glad all of that was sorted out and people could end up having this experience. Professor Martinez, you are native-born to Spain, I think?
Yes.
Had you been to Cuba before this study trip for any particular, or was this a first for you?
Was the first time for me, yes.
Wow.
No, it was a great opportunity to see this amazing country and hear the people, the language, and also see how the imprint of history with the Spanish, the colonial times. And so for me, the attractiveness to go to Cuba was in many ways cultural and just to connect to this country that it has been, was part of Spain for a long time. And,
right.
And just, there's those connections there that were very exciting.
Sure. So, and you could finally be there yourself right there to see it with your own eyes.
Yes. I mean, you study it on paper, you study the books, but then when you're there, you see it, you smell it, you taste it. And it's just experience we wanted to give the students too, like this, the kind of transformative experience.
Right. Before we hear from our students on what prompted them to want to go on this trip, I'd be curious to know from the two of you how this trip was billed. I mean, what kind of experience were you offering to any students and community members, for that matter, who wanted to sign up and have this experience?
Yeah, I'll start with, we wanted to give them an authentic experience from the tourist point of view. We like to explore, as we did in Peru, the impact of tourism in the economy, in the country, in the people, in the culture. So to look at, you know, us as tourists, how we have that impact, but also give the student the most authentic experience possible away from the touristic places.
Mm.
Right. So Havana was there mandatory, just like we did Machu Picchu in Peru, right? That's a place where you must go. It's more of let's go to the people. Let's stay with them at their homes. Let's go away from Havana and go to other rural areas that gives you a sense of what Cuba really is. And there are people without, just giving them an experience that wouldn't happen otherwise, with all the academic background, all the readings we provided them, so that they are there informed to be able to absorb everything and learn and have this really, really real experience. So with that in mind, we contacted an agency that would allow us to do all these visits and put together what the itinerary turned out to be, a great, diverse experience for our students.
Anything you want to add, Professor Robert?
I think Professor Morales covered a lot of it. So I think what we would say is that we tried to build an experience where students would get to see both the good and the bad. And that is that we didn't want this to be a course where students say, oh, no, the United States is horrible. In terms of, you know, look how horrible this embargo is. But we also wanted to challenge our students to understand that not all, that policies have impacts. So governmental policies have impacts on real people, and they got to meet a whole bunch of real people, and their experiences will be different from ours as well as each other, because they were doing different types of things and meeting different types of people on their own time as well. But on the top level, of course, we were talking about making sure they understood the politics, the economics, social issues are involved when it comes to Cuba. And of course, as Professor Morales said, the course itself is titled "The Role of Tourism in Cuba and Its Effects on Cuban Society." And as your listeners know, whenever they go to places as tourists, they have an impact on that local society. In Cuba, they just happen to have even more of an impact than you might expect, based on the nature of the way its economy is set up. And so we just tried to give them the full experience, and we didn't pull any punches. We made sure that they saw it from all sides, and the students will be able to give you a sense of that, I think.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, today's morning show is devoted to a study tour that recently was completed in the nation of Cuba. 10 Carthage students, 4 community members traveled to Cuba with 2 members of the Carthage faculty who are with us as well, Dr. Jeffrey Roberg and Dr. Maribel Morales Martinez. We are about to hear what occurred during this 15-day study tour. I'm curious first to hear from each of our students. Lauren, we'll begin with you. What prompted you to want to sign up for this? What intrigued you most about the possibility of traveling to Cuba, a place I assume you had never been before?
Yeah, a place I had never been before, and also a place I hadn't heard much about. And I think that was what really drove me to choose Cuba as the trip I went on this year. I'm a junior. I've actually been on 3 study tours total, so
wow.
I've traveled every single year of my Carthage experience. So this year, the offering of Cuba was really, that was my first choice, because in school, I never learned anything really about Cuba besides the Cuban Missile Crisis. So this class gave me the opportunity to learn on paper the history of Cuba, and then also experience it myself and be able to make my own reasonings about what actually a Cuban life looks like.
Very good. How about you, Claire Gunther? You're a senior, and what prompted you, maybe pull that just a little closer to you, what prompted you to want to be part of this study tour?
Yeah, I think I have a pretty similar answer. I'd never really learned much about Cuba prior to this past year when we talked about the Cuban Missile Crisis a little bit in some of my classes, but beyond that, nothing. And also, it was just a place that I wouldn't have the opportunity to go to myself, at least not very easily. So, yeah.
Are you, like Lauren, someone who's done a fair amount of traveling, or was this in some ways kind of a first for you?
Through Carthage, I've been on 1 J-term trip, so this would be my second one.
Very good. So, Professor Roberg or Professor Martinez, what kind of variety are we talking about in terms of the 10 students who ultimately went there? I mean, we have 2 political science majors here, for instance. Was that most of the students who were part of this, or not necessarily?
No, actually, we were all over the place. So we had finance, accounting, let's see, help me out here.
a wide variety of students from first year to seniors, right? So we had variety on that as well, and in their interest, in their backgrounds, and in the level of Spanish. So we had just diversity in many ways, yeah.
Very good. So I'm assuming a fair amount of prep occurred ahead of you actually departing for Cuba. Tell us, and actually maybe we should start, maybe direct that to the students, and then faculty feel free to chime in, but what occurred before the actual departure for Cuba in terms of preparing all of you for that particular experience?
So a lot of readings. I think Dr. Roberg is famous for that for all of his classes. Yeah, we had 3 days.
Famous or infamous, one of the two.
Yeah. 3 days of in-class sessions where we met twice a day for 3 hours to have some different discussions and lectures. Yeah, and then some paperwork, but not as much as you had to do in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say the readings were probably the most preparatory part, just kind of preparing your mind for what you may see while you're there. The paperwork wasn't that bad, just doing an e-visa, keeping photocopies of your passport, your ID on you at all times.
taking care of all of those kind of things. I'm assuming they also talked about a few sort of cultural things in terms of how to function there, how to stay safe, things like that, or not, so, or were they trusting you to function well there?
They talked a little bit about that, to exercise the same amount of caution you would as if you went to Milwaukee or Chicago, just to be street smart, that kind of thing. But yeah, also just they told us a lot about having patience, waiting in lines and that kind of thing is just a part of life in Cuba, and you have to be ready for that.
Mm.
They also told us not to bring any like outerwear with the American flag on it, which I noticed that there were a lot of Cubans themselves wearing the American flag while we were there. So I was like, okay, I understand not wanting to make yourself a target, though.
Interesting. So that's what that's about, that advice?
Well, so there's a couple different things happening here. So so first of all, as a general rule, it is a good plan to not have U.S. flags and U.S. paraphernalia and whatnot when traveling to Cuba and a few other countries as well. So we'll start there, and that's fine in terms of you'll see and they of course saw the Nike swoosh and lots of other U.S. advertisements and shirts and paraphernalia. But on our part, it's a matter of look, you already are not going to look like a local. Don't make yourself even more obvious than you already are. As far as safety aspects, the good thing about going to an authoritarian country is it's relatively safe, actually. so there is the side benefit of that. But of course, we want to make sure that our students remain safe. So we had some rules in terms of going out and whatnot. And what your listeners need to understand is, you know, going to a place like Cuba where we do not have full diplomatic resources available means that the U.S. government cannot get you out of trouble should you get into it.
Ah.
So we of course want to be safe with that. As far as preparation though for the trip, as Claire mentioned, as Lauren mentioned, we had. Of course, you know, lots of classwork ahead of time. So 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the afternoon. Yes, we did some of the administrative work, but we really spent a lot of time preparing them in terms of lectures, discussions having to do with understanding the politics of Cuba, understanding society of Cuba and what folks would be walking into. And so that when they see these various things and understanding the economy, et cetera, they have some frame of reference by which to understand what it is that they are seeing. One of the first hotels we stayed at in Cuba on the third day was we had a ton of people standing outside the hotel just down the street. And so one of the things we had talked about in class a number of times was the problem of transportation for Cubans. And these folks that were standing on the street were all waiting for colectivos, for small buses to come and take them on their routes. Uh-huh. Otherwise, you know, the interpretation could have been, well, these are just folks that are out of work and just kind of, you know, lazy or just standing around. They wanted to get to work. They wanted to get to where they were going.
And they can't.
This was the place that they had to meet in order to get those rides.
Wow.
So trying to give them context that way. Or the idea of Cuba, unfortunately, has been dealing with a variety of electricity outages over the last few years. And our students got to experience that too. And of course, while it's inconvenient for us, they also needed to understand or have a contextualization of what that meant for locals too, and how do locals deal with those kind of issues?
Right, to live with that,
right,
day after day, week after week, year after year. Yeah,
a lot of what I focus on in providing readings and providing context was for them to be aware of social issues and what to look for. And we asked them to write a journal and reflect on a series of questions and to prepare them to pay attention to certain things.
Mm.
And in my side, I wanted to want them to look at racial discrimination, race, the topic of women and women's rights and the situation in a very macho society and the LGBTQ situation, and just have to, you know, be aware of challenges of people and culture. So a lot of that then came out in questioning when we were meeting people and just observations about how many people were women, how many, what was the racial component of the people who we met, just giving them that kind of awareness of what to look for in a social context.
Yeah, very good. We're speaking with four people from Carthage College about a recently completed 15-day study tour of Cuba. We have with us two faculty members, Maribel Morales Martinez and Jeffrey Roberg, who helped lead this trip, and we have two of the 10 Carthage students who were along as well, Lauren Bukur and Claire Gunther. So to our students, explain over the course of these 15 days, basically how was the itinerary laid out, and how strict was that itinerary? Did it allow for much in the way of you to make certain choices, or was most of what you were doing, in a sense, kind of regimented with all of you kind of doing the same thing at the same time?
Well, one of the unique aspects about going to Cuba on an educational tour is the fact that you have to have the itinerary planned out ahead of time. So we had a many pages long itinerary detailing every single day and what we would be doing during our time in Cuba. I think the only kind of wiggle room we had was our educational sessions, which were called educational sessions, but really were hands-on educational experiences, so you go out and do what you will with that time.
Okay, so there was some freedom built into those kind of moments.
The government still requires that, you know, if we're going as under the educational license, that we actually are doing education. And so every day we had a formal plan, and a couple of days there were, you know, three speakers that we actually had. That was a heavy day. But we had educational aspects that we were doing every day to be able to, not only for the course, but also it might have been a little tighter than we would have done otherwise if the government hadn't said, these are the rules.
And is that our government or their government? Our government
US.
Has those rules about what this, so this is not a pleasure cruise to Cuba.
Correct.
Although, is there time for some pleasure, some fun?
I think some of the dinners were on their own, so then I think they can talk about what they did with that time, or running in the morning, right? So I think Claire can talk about her experience. I'm very proud of, you know, impressed with her going out in the every morning.
Tell us more.
So I run track and cross country at Carthage, and I needed to get my running in. So I would wake up every morning and go for a little run. Using caution as always, but I felt very safe. Havana was actually a pretty nice city to run in, just because there's not a lot of traffic with how expensive gas is and how expensive cars are, which isn't nice for the average quality of life, but it was very good for me as a runner.
Okay, well, looking for the bright side. That's great. Very good. So let's get a sense of the... Let's talk about some of the sort of the heavier aspects of this trip, and in terms of very specific, concerted learning experiences that you were given on this trip, and the kind of things that were a part of this, and what you feel like you benefited, in terms of what you experienced.
Well, I would say one of the heaviest parts of the trip was, we had one of our questions about how do Cubans reconcile their poverty with the perceived wealth of tourists. And while we were doing our walking tour of Old Havana, there were a lot of beggars who would come up to us, knowing that we were tourists, asking for money. And this wasn't the first time that I had experienced it. Like in Peru, they have it too, in many of the touristy areas. But in Cuba, it was just very prominent, and because they were everywhere, and everyone was struggling with the same economic poverty. So just being able to see that and experience that and know that you have the money that would help them, but also knowing that here in the States, Claire and I are broke college students with college loans. It's very hard to kind of like reconcile that within our own minds.
Sure. And of course, would be hard to make them understand your situation. I read someplace that one study shows that it's in the upper 80s, 80% of Cubans living below the poverty line. I was just staggered to see that. I don't know if that's exactly true. I don't even know to what extent it's possible to know just how extensive poverty is in Cuba. Does that statistic make any sense to you?
It does. I guess it's probably a little lower than that, but that's fair. And the question, of course, is how you measure it. Assuming it's on their own poverty line, then yeah, I think that's fair. About 35% of Cubans are engaged in some kind of private enterprise at this point in time. That's relatively new since 2011. Has been much broader than what it was before. So yeah, I think probably pretty close. Mm-hmm. Probably pretty close.
So I'm curious to hear from the students when you just, for instance, walked the streets of Havana or other places where you were. What did it look like? What did the structures look like? What did the people look like in terms of just kind of general standard of living and quality of life there?
Yeah, it depended on where you were. There was definitely a difference between tourist areas and areas where people actually live. The government invests a lot in the tourist areas, making the buildings nicer, maintaining them, picking up the trash off the streets, sweeping the streets, making everything nice for the tourists who are walking by and spending a lot of money there because that's how they get a lot of their money. And versus in the areas where people actually live, like the buildings are running down. A lot of the times the people are renting specific rooms or they own a specific room of the building and not the building itself. So no one is really responsible for the upkeep. And then when the building becomes unlivable, the people just have to leave and the government can tear down that building and use it to build a hotel or something like that.
Wow.
So yeah, definitely a difference based on where you are.
Or just leave it in shambles. So there are buildings that I saw back in 2002 that either aren't there anymore, meaning it's just an empty lot, or are frankly still kind of laying there. There's an area called the Malecón, as the students know, in Havana, which is any other place in the world would be prime real estate. It's just along the waterway. Mm. As you know, in the States, of course, we like to build our waterways, and that's where we put our most expensive property often. And this area, for large stretches of it, have buildings that are decaying and just or abandoned or you just kind of say, wow. And as Claire rightly said, you can own private property in Cuba, so folks own apartments, but no one owns the building. And so if an elevator breaks or it needs a paint job or a wall falls down, there's no one really there to fix that. There's no co-op or condominium fee or anything like that to take care of those issues.
Interesting.
Yeah, walking around, there were many plazas, and the setting that felt a lot like Spain. So when I was talking about going to a country that feels like your home country, and seeing those beautiful buildings, a mixture of northern Spain architecture, southern Spain, having that feel. But then the ones that are kept well are just absolutely beautiful. But then you see others that are just in ruins, and it's kind of heartbreaking.
Wow. Is it a problem to travel into those parts of Cuba? I mean, I could imagine the government not wanting, for instance, American tourists to see this part of the country, and yet your access to those parts of Cuba were largely unfettered? Is that?
Yeah, not anymore. I mean, there's no, I never felt, I'll back up. In 2002, we had folks that were saying, the police that would say, yeah, you're supposed to be over in that area.
Okay.
Same in a little bit in 2004. But this trip, I didn't feel that at all going around. And so the locals occasionally looked at us as oddities of, you're kind of here, okay. But there was never any kind of, you're not supposed to be here.
Okay. So they allowed you to see.
Right.
Even sort of the underside of the country. I'm curious to hear from the students about a couple of your most memorable experiences during this study trip, things that stand out for you. Lauren, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think Claire will agree with me on this, that one of our most memorable experiences that we shared together was actually having a very long conversation with one of our Casa Senoras. So we stayed with families and rented out private homes while we were in Cuba. And at our first Casa, we had a lady who was very interested to talk with us, and her daughter was in the United States. And so being able to have the very like intimate conversation with a real person in Cuba was probably one of the highlights of the trip for me.
Wow. And this is someone who spoke English, I assume?
No, she was speaking Spanish, but Claire knows a lot more Spanish than I do, and I was kind of able to follow along, like listening, but not saying anything.
Right.
We all kind of pieced together what we know, but she was very happy. She was very patient with us. That was something that really surprised me. I kind of thought Cubans would be resentful towards Americans for coming in with all this money and just that perceived difference in wealth. And also, I thought they would blame us for everything our government has put the people through with all the sanctions, the embargo, everything. But she was very, I mean, everyone was very willing to make that distinction between government and people. And she just was very happy to talk to us, even about complicated issues, wanted to get to know us as people. But yeah, the second she saw her friend Emma walk in, Emma's blonde, she was like, oh my gosh, she looks like my daughter used to look like. Starts talking about her daughter, and yeah.
Wow. So you said her daughter lives in the United States? Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, her daughter was, I think, a doctor or a nurse, and she made the trip from going into Nicaragua and made the journey up through Central America and crossed the border into the U.S.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I can see how that would be very, very touching, and also the kind of thing you maybe, that's not exactly part of the script. I mean, you hope there'll be these kind of encounters, and yet it sounds like you were just so fortunate to be staying with somebody who had that kind of openness.
Right. It's not built into the itinerary. It was a very lucky chance that we had such an open person hosting us.
Right. So what are the logistics for arranging these homestays in a place like Cuba? And what kind of people generally are opening their doors to having guests like Lauren and Claire?
So because of the limits that we're placed under in terms of the United States, we go through a provider. Cuba Educational Travel is who we use this time. We've used them before as well. And so they have their fingers kind of throughout the island and have a variety of connections. And so we talked to our provider of what kind of experience we wanted for our students. If we can avoid it, we try not to be in hotels because we want the students to be able to speak and have this experience that Lauren and Claire were just referring to. And I've certainly found that over the years with Cuba, that when you're in someone's home, and that's what these casas are. It's someone's home who's opened up a room. Essentially, think your listeners should think of it as an Airbnb kind of idea.
Right. Okay.
When they're in the privacy of their own home, Cubans are more than happy to speak with you about anything. Their hardships, their life, their desires, their worries, whatever happens to be. And so this certainly is what we ideally would like. In Havana, that was harder for us to do. But the other cities that we're in, we're able to replicate that and allow students this kind of experience.
Very good. What would be one or two other memorable experiences that stand out for you? Let's turn to Claire.
My other one would probably be in Trinidad. That was the other city besides Havana where we spent the most amount of time. It's about 3 hours east of Havana, if I'm remembering that right. But my senora there in the casa I stayed at was also very nice and welcoming. But probably my most memorable experience would be we were waiting to enter a restaurant on the first night, and this lady walks up to me, and she starts talking to me, and she realizes I could speak some Spanish, so we just start talking, and she's like, you look like a nice girl, and we're about the same height. Would you mind sparing a pair of pants? And I was like,
whoa.
I mean, sure, I'll talk to my professors. And they were right next to me, and they were like, she's a 70-year-old lady. She's not going to hurt you. Like, this seems like a safe situation. So I'm like, yeah, meet me here tomorrow, same time, same place. So I come back with another pair of pants, and I was going to hand it to her, and I figured she would just run off. She had gotten what she had wanted from the tourist, but she was like, no, sit down, let's talk. And we talked for like an hour. And
oh, wow.
her children have grown up and moved out, and she's just kind of lonely. So we end up just having this really nice conversation about her life in Trinidad and everything she's been through in the past few years. And it was probably one of the most authentic experiences I had there.
I can really imagine. That's
but
great.
Yeah, great lady. She works at a ceramic shop in Trinidad and just talked a little about that as well.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. How about you?
I think one of my favorite parts was getting to know the people we were with on the trip, particularly our tour guide, Luis. Mm. So we had a tour guide the entire time for all 15 days. And I initially thought that there would be no kind of connection built because I'd never been on this kind of guided tour. But we learned a lot about Cuba and Cuban people from Luis. Because he was very open to answering all of our questions. And we even went night clubbing with him one night, which I think was very fun.
Wow.
Not there.
No, I think, as you can see, I think our connections with the people there were made the most impact, right? Yes, it was a beautiful place. We went to nature, hiking in nature in one of, you know, a beautiful rainforest. And we went to the Bay of Pigs, and we had like all these different experiences in places. But I think all our memories are mostly from the people we met and those connections. We also had part of our itineraries visiting a clinic, so talking to a doctor, entrepreneurs from singers to people who IT maybe crocheted, wood sculptures, just amazing talent. And just all these people with great stories and a lot of passion. And it was just like really great to see. And so, yeah, I relate to kind of, but the best of it was kind of meeting the people.
Yeah, I bet. I'm curious, I assume there was some kind of issue with cell phone service, for instance. I mean, was that essentially non-existent? Or could you just whip out your phone and get on the internet just like back at home?
I mean, some people had plans where they were, I forgot what service it is, where they have text wherever they are. It just might be pretty slow. I had to keep my phone on airplane mode the whole time, and at some places there would be Wi-Fi, and I could send my parents a message on WhatsApp, but most of the time, just radio silent. I told them no news is good news.
Mm, there you go.
I tried buying an eSIM, actually, which you just download onto your phone so you don't need a physical SIM card. It didn't work.
Oh.
But we had a lot more Wi-Fi than was expecting. So there was no cellular service while we were out and about with our day, at least for us who just didn't have the Cuban SIM card, but people in Cuba can get SIM cards. But we had a lot of Wi-Fi, especially in Havana.
Okay.
But I actually think that not having cell service was a good part of the trip, a benefit, because a lot of the students actually bonded more because we were able to kind of sit down and have conversations.
Of course, you had to. Absolutely. So tell us about Cuban cuisine. What were you eating, and was there something particularly distinctive about it?
A lot of rice and beans for me. Had that about every day. It was pretty good. I guess my other favorite thing would be we would eat breakfast with our Casa families. So they would have a lot of fresh fruit, fresh juice that they would make in the house. That was delicious. Different pastries, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Claire didn't mention that she's vegetarian.
Yeah, that's probably part of it.
There was a lot of protein, too. I loved the pork there. And then there's like their ropa vieja, which is the shredded beef. That was great as well. A lot of fish, too. They're an island. And a surprising amount of Italian food. So pizza and pasta was offered a lot at a lot of the
really?
Restaurants we went to.
Interesting. So, Professor Martinez, I wanted to be sure to ask you about the whole matter of women in Cuban society. And you, of course, have taught a great deal in the Women's and Gender Studies program at Carthage. And you said that as you were going, that was a point of interest for you, and I'm sure Claire and Lauren might have something to add, Professor Roberg for that matter. But what is the, at least generally speaking, the place of women in Cuban society, and to what extent that you're aware has that changed at all in recent years from what it once was?
Yeah, so I know that after the revolution, the constitution was amended to have equal opportunities for gender and race. So women have access to equal opportunity for women and also for people of other races. So in a way, when that became something on paper, what is the real reality, right? So I had a conversation with a woman artist, and she said, yeah, things are, women, there's equal pay, right? So there's no discrimination on pay. Women have the same opportunities as men, but then there is the but. We're still in a very macho society, so women still struggle to have to prove their worth and have to, you know, women entrepreneurs talked about the different, the struggles they have because they're women.
Mm.
And women still carry a lot of the weight of the household. So a lot of the social things, they're still part of the our society as well. So, but we did see a lot of women empowerment. We, especially one psychologist, she gave us her perspective being an Afro-Cuban, but also being proud to be Cuban and to be a woman. And so there are some movements now intended to lift women up, and that there's that sense of women empowerment. A crochet, all women cooperative in which women are working in businesses, supporting each other. So in Trinidad, we met this a group of, you know, there's this business with women. So in general, I think we, when we ask questions about women and their struggles, it sounded very similar to other places where women are making advances and still needing, you know, a long way to go for actual equality to be a reality. So that was exciting. I don't know if they want to add anything.
Anything you want to add about that, about women in Cuba that you got to meet?
I think one of my favorite experiences as well was talking to this group of young female musicians, and their name is Chick Soul. You could look them up on Instagram if you would like. We got to have a little question and answer session with them, and they also performed for us. And when we were talking to them, they talked a lot about the challenges of being young woman in the music industry, young black woman in the music industry, not being taken seriously, having to wait in line, or not wait in line, but having to wait or have less... what's the word? Have other people get picked over them for different gigs and jobs just because they're younger and not taken seriously.
Right.
But yeah, and then the next day we actually went to a music festival and we got to see them perform on the big stage, and that was awesome as well, just to support them.
Oh, wow. Wonderful. Do you want to add anything, Lauren?
No, I think Claire did a great job. I think Chick Soul was a highlight of my trip as well. They were wonderful. And honestly, the music industry, but not really... there's no industry because it's kind of all amorphous.
Mm.
Like what is actually, are there rules to industry or not? And so that was also a problem that they faced too.
Sure. Speaking of problems, I think it was Professor Roberg who made passing reference to some electric outages, some blackouts or brownouts, because there's just this persistent, relentless problem with Cuba's infrastructure. So did you experience that directly, and what did that feel like to be, in a sense, kind of living through something like that or seeing that for yourself?
Yeah, in Havana we didn't really experience that, but definitely when we went out to the cities about a few hours outside of Havana, the electricity would go off for a few hours in the evening, or maybe more than a few hours, but that's when we'd take out our flashlights and yeah.
I remember waking up to get ready for the day, and it was 7 a.m., and the fan turned off in my room. So I was like, okay, power's out until around 4 or 5. But luckily, we were out for a lot of the day, so we didn't get to feel the stress of not having power. Like, our breakfast was already made by that point, and we didn't need to use our phones.
Mm.
So
there you go.
Yeah. We knew about it, but it just, until you're there and flicking the switch, and like, oh, there's no light.
Right.
Let's take out the flashlight. Or walking back from dinner, knowing that you have to have a flashlight with you so that you don't trip and fall and walking back to your house because it's pitch dark.
Wow.
And to know that when we talk to the people who live there, this happens all the time. You never know when it's going to go out. You don't know when it's coming back. So how do you live with that uncertainty of not having power? Like, we're so privileged. And we could live a few, like, 16 days there. But I don't know if we could ever, you know, get used to something like that.
Right. It's hard to imagine. And yeah, it does put things in perspective. So do you imagine ever going back to Cuba? I'm looking at our two students.
I would like to. My dad has always wanted to go, but it's just difficult as an American with all the rules we have on our side.
Mm.
But if I went back, I'd want to go with my family, maybe visit some of the people we met and see some more cities that we didn't quite get to.
Sure.
But yeah, practice some Spanish some more too.
There you go. How about you, Lauren?
Yeah, I would be open to the opportunity. My dad also wanted to go. He was really jealous for me going on this trip. We saw a lot of beauty there, even beyond like all the problems. So if I get the chance again, I'd love to go. But it just depends on the restrictions and who's in charge and our relationship in the future.
Right, absolutely. Some big question marks loom. Well, in the meantime, it sounds like it was an extraordinary trip on so many different levels, and 15 days probably wasn't enough. And they were 15 days you were in Cuba? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. So, but it's a big island with a lot to see and a lot to experience, and it sounds like you did an amazing job of giving the students something that they will remember for the rest of their lives. We've been talking today on the morning show about a 15-day study tour of the nation of Cuba led by Dr. Jeffrey Roberg and Dr. Maribel Morales Martinez, and two of the 10 Carthage students who came along for the ride on this trip, senior Claire Gunther and junior Lauren Bucour. I am so glad you made time in your busy schedules to be here on the morning show to talk about all that you experienced. And we wish you well with everything that stretches ahead for you. And thanks again for being a part of the morning show today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to speaking with Dr. Lynn Akey. She is the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And we will be talking with Chancellor Akey about the challenging landscape of higher education right now, and about some proposals in which the University of Wisconsin-Parkside might be reorganized in some fashion in order to be able to deliver its educational opportunities even more efficiently. And we will be talking with the chancellor about what some of that might possibly look like. On Thursday, it's Kaylin Palomares' monthly visit to the program. She always offers us an interesting program related to the environment. She has welcomed is welcoming with her Emily Proctor, who is an ecologist at Hawthorne Hollow. And they're going to be putting together an interesting conversation about love in the natural world, particularly love as it seems to play out between the creatures of the wild. Should be a really fun conversation. And on Friday, I'll be speaking with the author of a really interesting book called Romances and Practicalities. The author of this book, Jill Roth, had a romance with her soon-to-be husband, which had to span the Atlantic Ocean. And so wanting to become closer, but with that huge geographical gulf between them, she ended up compiling a list of 250 questions with which to better know this important person in her life. And from that, she's written this really intriguing book, which we'll talk about on Friday, which, of course, is Valentine's Day. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Let's look at a complicated weather forecast. We have cloudy skies today and some snow flurries with a high of 26, cloudy overnight with a low of 18. Tomorrow, Wednesday, is going to be very snowy. In fact, we are looking at 5 to 6 inches of snow, heaviest snowfall in the afternoon. A high tomorrow of 29 degrees. Still more snowfall is possible Wednesday evening. Sunshine finally on Thursday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.